You
absolutely
are.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, as always, we're pretty much talk about economics and how it applies to all these issues that people bring to us. Just in case, if you've never tuned into Punkonomics, we're basically a group of people who talk every week about economic issues, but not the type of way that your usual CNN and MSNBC, we're not even going to say Fox because who knows what they are. But yes,
we try to be entertaining.
We try to be entertaining and bring it down into a layman's terms so everybody can understand it. So,
especially since economists so often hide behind technical terminology that seems to make themselves smart. Well, actually, once you do the homework, spend the years, learn all the math and technology, then you can explain to anybody on the streets with half a brain why it's all beep.
Right. Today, we're going to definitely apply the economics to fairy tales.
Right. And before, we start digging into this, just to introduce, so we have a little economics talk show thing going here, and we love it. And Jesse here is, putting my family on the air. What can I say, basically, right?
Yeah.
Yes, ex-student, then he comes and say, hey. And there we are. So now we're technically pretty soon, we'll have all of them. My daughter definitely found quite the voice, Talia, on the fairy tale show. And she's it was funny. We listened to it yesterday and posted it on the new Facebook page that we finally made, Secrets of the Fairies. And we'll have syndication, iTunes and stuff coming up shortly, but the show is, the MP3 is already there for you to download. And it's funny, when we listened to it yesterday, it was like, we're all over the place, chat no way, talking about this and that, cracking jokes, messing up, and it's like my 10-year-old daughter Talia is the one who's keeping us on topic, and we getting us back properly, right?
I mean, when you listen to it, wasn't it translate like
she's
magic
the
all of a sudden?
One,
I mean,
right?
She's amazing. Well, she's amazing.
I jokingly can say that, shout out to Masterclass Academy. Well, finally all that investment in the acting classes is paying off. They do deserve a shout out. It's a great school. Really good. So the song is a wonderful segue, right? Because it's punk, I guess, to a point, The Damned, right? And it's doing White Rabbit, which is a little bit for now our... what Charlotte selected as our theme for the, as her theme for the fairy tale show. Well, it's a fairy tale show called Secrets of the Fairies, because there's a good reason to call it that, because there'd be a lot of secrets. Now, she's here for shameless self-promotion. It's my show, and she is, my better half, and therefore, there you are. But of course, maybe at least, so we'll soon explain and let her explain the whole story. What she does a little bit, because, what's interesting about it precisely is that she brings the social science, the background into the fairy tales, explain them with the economics.
And the truth about it is, they kind of put us to shame, the first show, all of a sudden the phone starts ringing off the hook and
look at,
we didn't even get that. Going like, what?
Yeah, we're just trying. We're trying to be as entertaining as possible on these topics, because you remember we used to joke. Everybody here, the economist on the radio, what's the typical reaction? Change the channel.
Exactly.
I do. And I'm an economist, because me it gets me angry often, I'm like, what the hell are you saying? You're lying. Fairy tales, my God, and it's an elephant in the room in a sense. I think it's such a huge fantasy. In the video gaming realm and fan fiction. It's this huge cultural phenomenon, and it has such a long history and importance. And it symbolizes. It tells us so much about societies in which they evolve, all of that stuff. It's awful sexy,
Right.
So it's obviously, I really think, Charlotte can tell you, for years I've been saying, stop writing academic papers and publishing and write a book for Oprah and
exactly,
we retire, So maybe with your help, actually, I'm finally pushing her down from the academic realms to communicate with people, which is important. But, I think the only link, really, the immediate link is that often in this show we do refer to things often as BS, but maybe could we refer it as fairy tales? Things like trickle down, job creators, equal opportunity, all those fairy tales that economists tell.
Uh-uh.
But they're not very. What are they? That could be an interesting question for Economics. Exactly. What is it?
You can't transfer your BS into fairy tales. It's not going
to
work.
Could we maybe? Is there a way to maybe start? Maybe we need to start writing economic
because
fairy tales. Good one.
This, thing like, fairy tales is for children and women and idiotic people and, it's like not true and all that. It's absolutely not right.
But wait a minute, the things I'm talking about, it's not just kind of silly, whatever. These are tales used to socially manipulate people.
Yeah, but when you say, it's a fairy tale, it means that it's not true and stuff like that. But this is really like a very patriarchal look down at women production of literature, essentially, sure. To say, it's a fairy tale.
High culture and low culture.
Of course, fairy tales are not true, in the sense that it's pretty rare to have, fairy godmothers coming to help you with a magic wand and stuff like that. It doesn't happen that much anymore, unfortunately. We kill too much forest, I guess. But the fairy tales, especially the fairy tales of the 17th century French fairy tales, which really is the institutionalization of fairy tales, and the word is not mine, it's Jacques Zipes, a very important scholar, like probably the most important scholar in fairy tales. They were really a mimesis of society. So, they had fairy godmothers that could transport them in their, beautiful chariots. Because remember, fairies don't have wings.
Our listeners don't know. I mean, there's no
show. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know.
It's kind of the key here, right? It's okay. This show is always a little messed up. It's kind of the nature of the beast. We'll have you over again, to dot the I's and cross the T's. But it's actually the society, your niche, if I can reduce it like this, is the society of late 1600s, early 1700s women who are writing these kind of socially...
Actually, late 17, early 18.
I said 1600s, and I got used to it, because a lot of people really don't like the centuries. I know from students, it is confusing until you get used to it, but 1600s, 1690s, what we'd call the beginning of modernity. So, and really, this is kind of when the world we can recognize today kind of came to be in terms of institutions and general political organization, economic organization, etc. It's the beginning of modernity. But anyway, they're kind of subverting, right? I mean, in some ways, I remember reading. These are proto-feminists, oh my God. They're telling things that today are probably in many ways too radical for Disney. And these women's aristocratic women are telling it a long, long time ago.
Yeah, that's so why they were completely eliminated, basically, from the French literary canon.
The process that always goes is this exclusion, right? I mean, what is the official high culture? You should read.
In France, it's very easy. Official high culture comes from the French Academy.
Yeah, so it's actually really official. It's not even implicit what is high culture suitable for college, but what is comic book or simple novel? No, not good enough. Fairy tale.
Could you tell us exactly where was the bedrock of fairy tales? Is it France? Is it England? I mean, where's the...
How they say fairy tales are timeless.
Timeless.
Yeah, absolutely.
Somebody must have capitalized on that one.
The structure of certain fairy tales, you can find them, like the skeleton, basically, of a tale
story,
is timeless,
right,
because it's been reinterpreted from, many, many, many years, centuries and millennia ago, up to now, up to Disney, okay? And every time it's the same skeleton, but the motifs, that make the tale itself change, and those motifs are completely anchored into society.
Okay.
So now, really, in terms of who invented fairy tales, really the term fairy tales comes from 17th century women literature. You don't find it before in dictionaries, although they didn't have many dictionaries. You don't find it in chapbooks and stuff like that. So they
popular literature again. And
the funny thing about it is, like, it's really a typo mistake. This fairy tale thing, it was, and that's why we called this show at the beginning the Tales of the Fairies, because that was the original title, the Tales of the Fairies, meaning that the fairies are writing the tales. They are also inside the fairy tales, but they are writing their own tales, basically. The fairies being the writers of the tales. So the Tales of the Fairies, also meaning the tales about the fairies. And then, because of a typo in Madame de Murat's book in 1998, it changed into fairy tale, and that's how it got translated in English in the 17th century.
Now we think of Tales About Fairies. Well, originally it was Tales Told by Fairies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
exactly.
So is it proprietary to France or England? I mean,
no.
Who's claiming it?
Well, Italians.
Italians?
Really Italians.
Ah. That specific tradition, right? Again, like she was saying, there's these standard stories, the poor girl lost, Cinderella. It's right. Always right in China, in India.
China, 900 AD was a Chinese Cinderella. Mm. You know, and then
so
even,
there's no
even
glass slipper, there's no necessarily ball, but the basic elements of the
exactly,
rich girl
the
lost, got cheated away from her inheritance, and eventually gets it back.
Even 3,000 years ago in Egypt, there is a Cinderella story, except that she's a prostitute.
No, okay.
But it's basically the same story. So the Italians really started to write them down. The first one is Straparola in 1550. He wrote a book, you know, like in the way Boccaccio and the Canterbury Tales.
Hey,
sorry,
were
written. You know, like I know I still can't pronounce it, but yeah, we lived there for a year. But you know how they are all set up in a frame story. You know, like some people have a problem, like Boccaccio. You know, there is the plague in town, so they need to go outside in a castle somewhere up the mountain to avoid it, and to pass the time. They tell each other stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the frame, and then the stories come inside and stuff like that. Okay, Straparola did a book like that in 1550, where we find only about 14 fairy tales, and the rest of the book are not fairy tales. There are other stories, you know, legends. Any kind of folk stories, you know, but not fairy tales per se. And then in 1634, Giambattista Basile published a Napolitan, the first book of fairy tales for real, because it's a book of, it's called the Decameron, and it's 5 days, 10 stories. No, Pentameron.
Yeah, I was like, what, the same
Sorry,
name?
Sorry, oh my God, they are so complicated, because the French did one too. And so anyway, the Pentameron, which is also called the Tale of the Tales, and it's 50 tales, and the 50th tales is basically the frame. It's this girl that got robbed of her husband by her servant, and finally she gets the guy back by telling her story. So typical Scheherazade stories and stuff like that. Yeah. But Scheherazade was also, I mean, it's also a book of fairy tales that has been written many, many years ago, but it didn't come to Europe until the late 17th century, and especially the early 18th century, 1704, when it was translated and published by Antoine Galland. And that's when it spread all over Europe. So basically, the French didn't invent anything. They just spread it out. And there were a lot of...
And developed the genre, I think.
Well, yeah, they developed the genre already at court, those. You know, saying the stories, you know, the typical stories of restoration. There are really two ways... Why am I taking all over this show? It's about economics. economic point of view, actually, there are two formats of fairy tales. One is the tale of restoration, and the other one is the tale of... Damn, I forgot the word. Sorry, eight. It's what? Too early.
Restoration.
Restoration and...
It's kind of like Cinderella. She gets back what's hers, that sort of thing. Ah, and like... giving the finger?
Let's talk about the tale of restoration. I'll think of it later. Tale of restoration is that you have a prince or a princess that has been casted out of her place for a reason, his place, and goes through a quest, a journey, and with the help of a magical person, gets it back. It's restored to its formal place.
Okay.
Right? Usually it involves princes and princesses, and never does it involve folk. And the other one, the other one is the tale of elevation, and that's the kind of Jack and the Beanstalk. You know, somebody or Puss in Boots, somebody that has who has nothing at the beginning, and at the end wins the prince of the prince or the princess hand.
Mm-hmm. So, but what makes it a fairy tale? Because I gotta say, I can think of economic propaganda, you know, and concepts that are really told in a precisely in this metaphoric, homely way. I mean, we've discussed it. A classic one that both right and left in America are using, and economically speaking, is silly, profoundly, and damaging, is this notion of the American economy as like a household economy, right? This
right.
notion, if we can't run a deficit, it's really fundamentally wrong. At the most fundamental level, it's not an argument that I'm saying I have a certain position. I mean, nobody. There's no one academic paper, not one book, nothing to support that. It's purely a kind of propaganda, and it's designed for a purpose.
You know, if I can jump in, the way that is put together in a propaganda type form, or at least to convince people to just kind of like jump into the whole economic scheme of it, is the whole thing of the white picket fence, where they tell the women, or at least back in the 50s and all that, I know from my mom's point of view, is that your expectations were to get married and have the kids and have the white picket fence. And that white picket fence actually represented the economic advancement of that family, whether it was, you know, women and men together, but as a whole, not as an individual. So they just kind of like constrain individualism to no end. But every single time, I mean, I used to get it from my colleagues at work, from the flight attendants, who we tend to be very independent. And at one point they would go like, well, you know, I kind of want the white picket fence, the fairy tale type thing, and, you know, hopefully I can snag a pilot, you know. And it's always that perception of the prince being the guy making the money, the doctor, the lawyer, you know, the pilot. It was always looked that way. Versus here, there was really, until recently, there was no female in that position of wealth and authority, or at least they weren't given the credit that it deserved, you know, and that. But I still hear the white picket fence.
Oh, everywhere, in a sense, you know, we criticize Disney about it, right? All the Disney princesses, almost, or Charlotte Last Show, I mean, you know, you'll have to watch both to understand how actually Disney got... tangled correctly, in a sense. There was an argument last when they explained to us that usually Disney doesn't get it right, in fact, precisely because the original stories, not those Italian original stories that Charles is describing, but the French circles that were rewriting them, that are the topic of Charles' research primarily, they wrote these princesses who don't depend on any prince, who do it themselves, who know this kind of, you know, girl, toughen up, the world's tough out there, you need to take care of yourself, and things like assume responsibility, be proactive, etc. The very opposite of what we caricaturally call in feminism pretty passive and polite,
right?
Which most Disney princesses fall to. So yeah, like you're saying, you know, we taught that in many ways. Many social critics today are talking about our society being anti-feminist again. And Charlotte goes to the archives and looks at the history.
And you know, it even goes even further from a psychological point of view. You're actually setting up a person to fail, because if they're thinking about, you know, this person has this and that, and they're not looking at the compatibility or the love it winds up transcending into divorce.
Setting up to fail is very important. In fact, it's central to marketing. There's anthropological research on that. I recommend a really cool documentary that I showed all my students, whether they like it or not, called Star Suckers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a right. British 2009.
Awesome.
Isn't it great?
Awesome.
But as it goes, it's entertaining, kind of cool, one of those new documentaries. But at the same time, it really kind of goes into the detail to an extent, to an entertaining, precisely good balance, I think, of how this works. So this notion of the economic side of it, right? Work hard, stay in school, right? Do the right thing, make the right choices, and you will, you will do well. You will pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And you look at the data. In the good old days, the 60s, early 70s, when American capitalism was humming along at its best in history, it was in the teens, and remarkably high. Teens, what's teens? Chances of dying richer than your parents.
Right.
Now it's negative.
Right.
For the majority of Americans, we will die poorer than our parents in terms of our standard of living, access to resources, everything, that we measure generally in economics as economic well-being. So here's a fairy tale. Isn't it like the worst of the bad fairy tales, in a sense? Most people fail. They blame themselves.
Right.
And then you are actually sensitized, this notion of I need to be doing well, but I'm not, so I'll buy another thing, and see if maybe that'll work. And meanwhile, ka-ching, you're more and more miserable. Because they're motivated, right? When I read your paper, it kind of judges, what's the social message of those fairy tales, right? And in what sense you can understand the society at the time and in the economic and political context and whether these women were trying to kind of push back against the society of the time in multiple ways. And to some extent, don't we always do it today? Economists, perhaps more than physicists, because we deal with different subject matter. Physics is easy, you see, because rocks, planets, except at the quantum level, don't just decide to change their minds. And even that's probabilistic. And people really aren't. There's so much radical uncertainty. So that's why economics is so hard. Because, it's a mess. But you're right, propaganda. How about propaganda? It's my topic, right? I think there's some of these similar structures. Maybe more the paternalistic kind. I'm not sure. Maybe the problem is that some of economists need to start telling better fairy tales, by the way. I didn't think of that. So now it's great.
To have a fairy tale. Now there are many things that are considered fairy tales that are not fairy tales. Yeah. Like for example, Little Red Riding Hood is not a fairy tale. Mm. It's an initiation tale, if something.
What's
or
the criteria?
A cautionary tale. The criteria is, and this is Raymond Robert, who said it perfectly. But just to make it very short. You have to have, first of all, a world that is self-contained, like a microcosm in which the fairy tale happens. This is this kind of own little world. Second, you have to have, at the beginning of the story, the understanding of the problem. Let's take Sleeping Beauty. At the beginning of the story, you have the fairies that come to the birth of the baby, and they give them gifts, beauty, singing, dancing, blah, blah, blah. And then there is this fairy that was not invited that who gives the baby the curse of dying. And then there is the seventh fairy in Perrault's tale. There are three, I think, in the Grimm's tale who counteract, that last fairy cannot reverse entirely the curse, but say, okay, you're going to sleep for 100 years and then you're going to wake up. Okay, so that's, we know from like the first paragraph what the problem is. And we know, because we know what the problem is, that it's going to end well. Because we know that we're going to find a solution, especially because there are very good mothers to help you. So I don't know about the economic stories, but first of all, I very much doubt that they said the problems first. And I even much more doubt that they solve it at the end. Because they are not very good mothers, all those economists,
politicians,
and stuff
like that. I
don't know,
maybe start
the
field of, fairy economics.
And why is it...
Hey, that's a good term, fairy economics. I like that.
Fairy economics.
Put it in my
maybe,
bio.
Exactly. We need fairy economics, economists. you know, to reestablish the problem.
Because these are really motivated stories by definition. I mean, hence my work on rhetoric. That's kind of where I dedicated my career, in a sense, that realizing that, wait a minute, the facts aren't facts. We are actually telling stories. You know, yeah. And it's a big, you know, not some freak out there. There are very important people who have inspired me and work on this notion of really understanding a science as a dialogue, as an ongoing argument, a conversation, Sprachethik. I'm not going to even get, though maybe one day we do a show a little bit on that element. That we tell stories like shaman around the fire, essentially. We haven't really fundamentally... they're more persuasive on different levels. One of the problems is that you think that in science, persuasion should be based somewhat on facts. Facts aren't perfect, but you put something on the table that refutes what I think is true, I have to argue back, at least, right? Right. Why your data is wrong, why you're misinterpreting it, and eventually be open to the idea that maybe I'm wrong. Time to change my mind. If you're not open to that idea, you're not really doing science, but it's so much more effective. That argument is kind of the scientific argument, modernity, same time, interestingly, right? I mean, that's where people start talking like this for the first time. Mm-hmm. In the 1600s, maybe initially a little bit before, but it doesn't catch very quick. I mean, by then it's beginning to catch, the late 1600s, exactly. But it's much more effective politically today like never before. And always, though, to tell stories that are persuasive, not because of some kind of standard of data or logic, deduction, induction, but because they mesh well with your personal feelings and typically right. ideology. Oh,
yeah. Everybody likes right? a
I
good
like
story.
To hear the story that rich people are rich because they're splendid, talented, hardworking. And the rest of us are, what did Romney call us? Takers.
Takers, right.
Takers, right?
Mm-hmm. I hate that story.
I'm coming to take. Yeah, we're coming to take you.
Yeah.
No. We'll take, no problem, buddy. But okay, apart from that like little hatred, because really, it is hateful. Yeah. It is hateful.
It is hateful.
But no, it's a definition. I'm not even mm-hmm. making a judgment. This is hateful speech, you know? Right. You tell you guys are all
right
worthless and... We are. It's a hateful speech by definition. Well,
that's very monarchic.
But you see, I mean, so when you're rich, yes, it feels absolutely. Good to hear that, right? It feels good mm-hmm. to hear it. And it's
right.
It
validates your existence and efforts.
Right. Why am I rich? Because in most cases, because I got pretty good seed money from my parents is the correct statistical
right,
answer.
Right.
You know?
Well, in most cases, it probably would have shot the tooth fairy, too.
Yeah.
Coming into the house.
Right.
Because usually the rich are the ones with the guns, for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. That is the important and bias there, right? We think, oh, it's all these poor criminals. And again, poor criminals. Criminal, poor. It's almost the same thing. We're back to the 19th century when people who were poor and didn't have a work were locked up in jail and enslaved.
Right.
And it was a punishment. How come you don't have money, you know?
16th century.
Oh, throughout a long time, by the way, in many different instances and different, yeah.
Like from... Always.
So, still today,
since
I would
we
say
have a
to
civilization.
Some extent, still today, the credit, much of the story of debt, personal and public in America, is a story of willful class warfare and manipulation. I'm sorry.
Yes,
I got
it
all
is.
Crazy yesterday in propaganda class, pointing out, as I have already, I think, in this show, how what a racket the deficit is. It's the same people who took the bailout are making money off of it.
Right,
they're charging us interest on the money we gave them.
It's beyond comprehension, I know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what is this? It's a joke, it's such a circus. But the power...
It's not really beyond comprehension. Yeah. What's beyond comprehension is that it happens in a democracy.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's been happening...
No, it isn't. Frankly?
Oh, because it's not a democracy.
Exactly. It is a key. I keep going back. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could so many things
yeah, well,
we're talking
we
about.
We think we still live in a democracy.
But we're not. We really
fewer and fewer people. Yeah, and I think that is a source mm-hmm. of hope to me. That whatever our ideologies about economy and politics, life and universe and everything is, I think there's a strong, solid majority. I mean, when you could, you know, approval rating of politicians, I think people know this system is failing.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
at that point, the spinners, the tail spinners, yes. kind of come in there and explain that failing in different ways. Most notably today, I believe, if I have to not launch into a 3-hour speech. Don't worry. And don't worry, my wife's here. So if I start about 10 minutes in, I get slapped in the face. I'm well trained that way.
And I also heard the volume number.
Right. Yeah. Even my kids are beginning to raise the arm, you know, when I start launching now. Getting ready. The failure of the political system, then we know it's failing, but then you got like the one side that pulls, oh, it's government. And they have a point. It's a sin of omission is their main problem, you know? And then the other side, oh, no, it's big business or small bit, whatever, you know, the business, the capitalists.
Isn't it the
whatever.
Same thing?
Exactly the problem.
Right.
The problem is, go back to your Adam Smith, you know, the thing that'll kill capitalism, another way of summarizing Adam Smith's work. Like, what will kill the market system is when there will be a small, powerful group of very rich individuals who will own the government.
Right.
Colbert.
That's the
Colbertism.
Yeah, but back in England, back then, they look at the French, who were the world superpower. It would, you know, to think that England will one day dominate France in still the 1600s, maybe by the end, I think that was beginning to show.
Yeah.
But by the beginning of that 17th century, it would be like saying that, I don't know what, what would be, I don't know, that Canada will overtake America or something. It would about like that, you know? That small place with low population, generally poor, interesting in many ways, but has no real resources, lousy weather, no wine, wealth drinking.
Right, right.
Which the British got into, you know, like many wars to secure the sources of French wine. Nobody appreciates French wine like the Brits. Funny though, by the way, isn't it? The long story of Britain and France, it's like, you know, the kind of love-hate relationship, like two siblings really fighting all the time, but siblings nonetheless.
You know, that's good that you brought that up.
100-year war was about that. What?
Right.
No Aquitaine wine? You kidding me? Invade!
Was there any fairy tales put together just to address that divide between the French and the British? I mean, was there any stories that came up or that you know of? No?
No, because really the fairy tales written at that time, so at the end of the 17th century, were really concerned essentially with their own problems. And I'm talking about the aristocratic or the high bourgeoisie problems. I'm not talking about the peasants. The peasants have nothing to do with fairy tales. At that point. And then, yeah, it's been folklorized, you know, it's been passed down through chapbooks and stuff like that and folklorized.
Which is because she's going to be too timid. So I got to say, I mean, Charlotte McCartney discovered that and kind of blew a couple of major minds in the academic world about
this.
Well,
it's not like I discovered it. There are people that say it way before me. And in fact, there are two schools. One is the one following Rudolf Skender, which is a German scholar. And here in America, it would be Sue Bottigheimer in Long Island, CUNY Long Island, that are saying that basically the book is at the origin of the fairy tales, and yeah, let's say the classic fairy tales. And then there is the other school, which is basically advocated by Jack Zipes and even Louis Cypher. You know, eminent scholars anyway that say, no.
She's dropping names.
I'm dropping names, sorry.
It's the scholar, you know, she's, you know. She's
just in case they ever listen to that
this.
Show, I want to give them the credit. Yeah,
right,
absolutely,
right, yeah.
Because I didn't invent that all by myself. I did a lot of research and
some archival evidence. I really, you know, that one of the things you didn't theorize about it, but you actually found was like, in Missouri that you tracked like ancient tales as they are collected by scholars, and then you compare it to the text that was published in France, a book, and basically proving that these folk tales from the rural Missouri people telling them, where'd they get them? They brought them from France, from their grandmothers, from the governors. No, they read it in a published book.
Well, then they
started telling each other around the fire. But they read it started from books to oral, to which is.
So a lot of those theories. I mean, you know what? It's always a back and forth. You can't say, you know, oh yeah, it's all from the book, and then it went from the elite people to the peasants. I don't think Jack and the Beanstalk was a elite story. It's actually a folk story. You know, it's got all the signs, all the motifs of folk people. There are a lot of folk stories that, you know, like the writers of fairy tales have taken motifs from to form their own fairy tales. But and it's always because, you know, fairy tales are supposed to be timeless, whatever that means. In fact, they are very much anchored in time. Every version is really related to the time when it was written or told. Where I was going with that? That it's also like a back and forth, you know, they are from literature, like from mythical, let's say it's a mythical story that gets, you know, with the fall of the Roman empires, it gets passed down into the people, you know, which keep it during the Dark Ages, and then it comes out in, you know, early medieval stories, you know, by the priests and the clerks, you know, who wrote the stories that probably took them from the folk and then
get reinterpreted, you know, a little bit every time.
Right. And then so it becomes a book, it becomes an elite story again, and then from that elite story it goes back down into the people, and then it comes back up through a book, and you know, it's like a lot of those stories, you can bring them back to mythology. In fact, there is a lot of mythological elements into the fairy tales.
Always, right? Metamorphosis was available. That didn't get burned by the Christian fundamentalists in Alexandria.
Yeah,
like so much of the classic literature that.
Yeah.
Now you basically brought up something that I've been wanting to ask you, and I know Benny, Dr. Balak's opinion about vampires.
Dr. Balak.
Yes, you know. Anyway, I know Benny's opinion about vampires and all that, because you did post it on Facebook, and I think I answered to that. How does, let's say, a writer like Anne Rice, who does vampire stories, who's very well known, okay, and I've read her books. I mean,
I read one of those back in the 80s when it kind of came out, I think. I read one of
those. You know, and particularly like the vampire Lestat, an intense character. How does the fairy tales compare to that kind of writing, that genre? Because, I mean, if for some reason you can't mix that.
Well, you know, vampires is barely folklore, right? I mean, and I'll say something, and you fill me in on the analysis of this a lot. But remember, we looked it up a little bit with the family, with the kids and everything, and kind of said, where is the whole vampire thing coming from? I mean, we know with the Bram Stoker novel, it's so 19th century, it's all about Victorian repressed sexuality. That's what makes Twilight. Am I going to lose a lot of audience? Oh, well, but my kids are listening, so I got to give them that. That's why Twilight is so awful.
I agree.
Because it doesn't do it right. Maybe Charlotte can, you know, it doesn't do it. I mean, there's no, you can't have a vegetarian, try Little Red Riding Hood with a vegetarian wolf. How does that work out for you? You know? I mean, how can you write about sexual repression with like sparkly, you know, Jonas Brothers, it called? The purity ring, abstinence.
But you're talking about the movie, though.
What?
You're talking about the movie.
Well, I didn't read the book. I watched the movie. Remember, together we tried to watch as much as we could.
I think the book is much better than the movie.
It is.
Yeah.
Well,
it usually is. Yeah, it usually is. But I mean, you know, personally, I mean, I'm a True Blood fan, so Twilight, they can have it. And the reason I bring up True Blood is because their whole story is basically going back in history in Louisiana. Okay, and it's almost like where Anne Rice left off.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like the story is being told through a period of time, just like the fairy tales. Mm. But for some reason, I just don't see why they're not together or put into.
Because you could you make it? You know, in a sense, the whole vampire stories and werewolves too. I mean, these probably do have folkloric, pretty vague, general folkloric notion. Of course. But it's
werewolf. Yeah,
it's certainly, there's no tradition other than 19th century, so very recent in historical
terms.
No,
werewolves.
Werewolf. Yeah, but not vampires. There must have been something. Maybe some. There's not even much of that. Just like Charlotte, people went to Transylvania. Yeah, you know, right. Back from where I hearken from. You know, in the today it would mostly be typically in Romania, but borders were different those days in Central Europe.
And barely there was, maybe that was even actually from British writer Bram Stoker, got, since it's, they were mentioned in the book, they just, oh, yeah, yeah, sure, yeah, vampires, you know. And today, of course, they have every second bed and breakfast is like Dracula's something or other around that region because they want to make money from tourists.
Sure.
But you see, it's kind of barely even folklore. It's just something that some kind of marginal folklore that this guy really builds up in a very 19th century, completely 19th century context to the story of Dracula. I think, well, since it's my show, I can say, I have a theory about werewolves that I always like. You've probably heard it before. But why, what's the werewolf theory? Here's the werewolf theory. Dogs, right?
Okay.
We've had dogs since the famous bad words in history, the dawn of time, right?
Right, pretty close.
Since pre-civilized, pre-sedentary, already pastoral hunter-gatherers, we already had dogs. Who are these dogs? These are kind of wolves that domesticated. Instead of hunting by themselves and escaping humans or competing with humans, because we kind of tend to forget these days as we destroy the planet, that until recently we were more on the menu than sitting at the restaurant in most cases, you know? We were competing with the wolf, and if there were a few wolves against the, you know, it might win even. What about the wolves who did not domesticate, who stay in the forest and sometimes kill our children or compete and eat our food and our children starve? What about the potential dog that's gone feral? That's though very dangerous, as we know, because they know humans, right? And are not afraid of them like wolves and all that. So I see the werewolf as the wild man. The man who was domesticated, chose not to be domesticated or undomesticated himself, chose to leave society and go live wild and free in the forest. And we hate them. They are a threat to our society.
Well,
they're evil. That's why we hate
them.
Wolves, I think, by the way. Because really, there's not that much of a reason. Wolves
are rapists. It's a well-known thing.
Yeah, but why? I mean, bears are scary. You know,
right,
I mean, the other animals would be. Wolves were not that dangerous historically. You know, sometimes in very cold and hungry winters, they could be so desperate that they would kill humans. But it wasn't like such a major. It's a weak animal.
You know, I sort of agree with.
It's
what
the
you're saying.
It's the treachery.
Right.
You see, why are you not a dog? Essentially, why are you not a civilized man but a wild man? Why are you not a dog but a wolf?
What I can tell you is that when Little Red Riding Hood was written in the 17th century, there were hardly any wolves
already.
Left
yeah,
in
right,
France.
Right.
It was. Oh, okay. This is the first time this story has been written. Actually, we don't have any trace of it in anything. Not in mythology. Not in medieval literature. Not in foreign literature. It was written really at the end of the 17th century, and folklorists have looked at back histories, and there were a mention of a fact in the 50s in a newspaper that a kid had been eaten by a wolf. You know, that made the story in the entire kingdom.
In the 1600s, right? In the 17th
century. 1650. Okay. That made the story in the entire kingdom because it was so rare. And we don't even know if it's a true story. It's a fait divers. Like, the wolves, at that time, the wolves were already almost eliminated from Western Europe, probably not from the forest of Eastern Europe, which had a much bigger and denser forest.
Still has the last little patch of forest.
Exactly.
In Europe.
But in France, we have, at that time, we really had domesticated our nature. We call it the Middle Ages the domestication of nature.
Think of those crazy French gardens. That's
the
when
Roman
they did it,
of
you
the
know,
rose
the super
and all that.
Beautiful, elaborate, sculpted gardens. That's when they invented it, the symbolism of conquering nature.
Could it be that the Little Red Riding Hood was actually put together to bring back the wolves? You know, from extinction.
Ooh,
you know, just kind of.
No.
You know, kind of like.
No,
watch out. You know, they're scary. Stay away from them, and that way there's no human interaction,
no,
and
that's
they breed
not
and come back. No.
Well, because in the time of Perrault.
Unlike in Twilight, when there are a bunch of male strippers. No, that movie is not just bad. I mean, there's awful movies like 2012. You know. The most ridiculous movie in history.
I'm so glad they didn't go and see that.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, 2012. Oh, Fyro, what's it called? Oh, I wish Felix was here. You know, Fyro something blast, you know, when a volcano explodes, it goes like 600 miles per hour, you know, a wall of what killed Pompeii and everything, just a wall of burning dust, of burning embers and such. In 2012, a dude kind of outruns it, you know, and jumps on the plane and takes off. You know, just
completely stupid movie, you know? But Twilight is just wrong, you know?
I would have been so upset if I would have paid for that.
The werewolves are like a bunch of Chippendale crew, you know? The vampires are sparkly vegetarians. What's a sparkly vegetarian?
I think we lost a 25% of our audience.
They glow in the day.
I'm sorry.
We're going to get a lot of hate mail from the Twilight
the
people.
Twilight? Yeah.
Now, I know a lot of people that have read the book and said the books are great, but the movie is ridiculous. But
and I'm being
coming
you know,
back to the wolf in the 17th century when that story was written by Perrault, a wolf was a synonym for someone that really liked women. It was well known, like Racine, you know, the biggest tragedy writer of classical literature, French classical literature, wrote everything. Well, not everything, but a lot. He called himself a wolf because he loved women.
Translated an American would be a player?
Possibly.
Right? Does a player get
well,
the women?
Actually, no. A player is somebody who takes advantage of women.
A wolf gets the women.
But the wolf also kind of takes advantage
it's,
of them.
You know, it's like, I don't know if you say
Don
that
Juan,
in English,
right?
But to be
Don
eaten
Juan.
By the wolf is synonym of...
Losing your virginity.
Yeah. In French, anyway. So it's like it's completely intended by the intended readers at the end of the 17th century.
It's understood right away.
The wolf is not the wolf.
Oh, okay.
You know,
yeah,
it's
you
only
get the
like...
The people need to get the metaphors, right? I mean, you have to have a community of people or your audience when you write something, I mean, to work.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying that the fairy tales are absolutely not timeless in that sense that they are always, they only can be understood within context. If you lose the context outside of the fairy tale, then you don't get it, especially in the case of 17th century fairy tales because they are really mimetic of the society in which the tellers lived. They write for them. They write knowing about them will... You know, they really write for their friends. They are not writing for children or anybody else.
And it's hardcore. I mean, you'll have to listen to the show on Wednesdays for this, but we don't want to spill the beans. We're almost a little bit too much on Little Red Riding Hood. It's all about sex. And the way it's not just, I'm sure a lot of you are saying, well, yeah, I get it, you know, already. But no, there's a lot of detail you don't, precisely because Charlotte will explain eventually when we do that fairy tale how the specific food she brings... It tells our audience what's going on, the specific order in which she moves. And every detail of that story is conveying. But again, economics, you know, we have all that. That's why I study it. It kind of, people tell you economic stories on the radio or the TV, and you don't even catch often the specific, often strong assumptions being made in that little discourse if you're not a professional. And so many professionals don't even either. So I still see that nature. Maybe it's in every piece of meaningful writing that you have, on the one hand, some kind of structures, logical, general stories that are timeless, potentially, such as, you are poor, but you shall be rich one day, without even specifying how, shall we say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Here's a type, and always an issue people considered from the dawn of time.
Elevation tale.
From stratified society, shall we say.
Yeah, there are, in fact, about those restoration and elevation tales, there are much more elevation tales that are folk in origins. In the restoration tales, they are almost never folk.
Well, makes sense, right?
Obviously.
Who cares about restoration? Somebody who was rich, at least at some point, and lost it.
Yeah.
Elevation is when you're low, then you want to
be
low.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's really interesting because there's so many, I really think there's so much of propaganda is really kind of based on these little stories that are not so different. We'll have to argue about, are they not fairy tales? Maybe some of them are. I'm just excited in the sense that maybe these understanding fairy tales can be...
I think maybe you should write, fairy tales, like, you should write the economies of today's within, in a fairy tale format. Because that's what they did back at the time. I mean, if you look at the women's fairy tale, it's all about economics. And in their economics, like, which is the preservation of the, race, which they called it, which is really a blue blood and nothing else.
Aristocrats. Concerns with their DNA, you know.
Yeah, they were really concerned because of Colbert and all that.
All that
Richelieu
inbreeding,
before him.
Very good.
Well, inbreeding was good, because you inbreed, you keep your titles and you keep your land.
Right.
If you don't inbreed and you start selling your daughters to those wolves which belong to the bourgeoisie, you know, middle class.
Middle class, it was rising at the time.
Rising because of Richelieu and Colbert, exactly, taking over the government, you know. You were totally selling to the third class, you know, the third class.
Of course, everybody was doing it because they needed the cash. Right.
Yeah, and that's why, exactly. And
bad butt.
Yeah. And that's what women wrote about. I mean, most, like, an enormous amount of their fairy tales talk about basically the Beauty and the Beast, you know, the girl that is married to a horrible monster. The horrible monster is most of the time a gentleman from the government of Louis XIV.
Okay, well, wow.
Yeah.
Time flies.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, time flies when you're getting a free education here.
Right. Yeah. Do
you think I can get credit for this?
That's the problem. We could talk all about that, you know, the monopolies of education.
Free education.
I need the accreditation, baby.
Fairy tales are free education.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Right. That's exactly what they always were for. So.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, folks, we're concluding our program here on Punkonomics. And again, you can definitely catch Secrets of the Fairies Wednesdays at 9 o'clock. And, of course, we are here every Friday.
And there is a Facebook page, and soon to be, it's busy times, you know, but soon to become, you can subscribe to it, etc.
So anyway, have a great weekend. Remember, you can always give us a call during the program at 407-646-2915. And, you know, make sure you do check into Wednesday's programming at 9 o'clock with the Secrets of Fairies. I'm definitely hooked on it already. So.
Yeah, and participate. Actually, in the Secrets of a Fairy, the whole idea of, like, community participation, it could be super cool. But generally, yeah, let us know what you want. Talk back to us, please.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The preceding program did not reflect the views